Good afternoon or good morning to everyone, depending where you may be and where you're joining us from today. Welcome to the Accessibility Online webinar series, which is a collaborative effort between the ADA National Network and the U.S. Access Board. Before we begin our session today, I just want to run through a few of the things in the webinar for those of you that are using the webinar system. So if you're not familiar with it, we'll just cover a few of the details. We do have closed captioning available for this session. If you're interested in using the captioning, click on the CC icon at the top of your screen, or if using a keyboard, Control F8, and adjust the captioning screen as needed. You may also customize your viewing today of the session. If you choose View from the menu bar at the top of your screen, and then choose the layout that you prefer from the drop-down menu. This is something that you can play around with. If you would like, it will only affect your view. It will not affect anyone else's. We are taking questions for today's session. Our presenters will be responding to the questions. You're asked to type your questions and submit them in the chat area text box. For those of you using a keyboard, it would be press Control M and enter your text again in the chat area. The questions will only be viewed by the moderators and the speakers. You will not see the questions that are submitted, but the presenters will be reviewing the questions and responding to them accordingly in the question and answer period of this session. We also ask you to refrain from using any of the emotions or hand-raising features that are available on the webinar platform unless you are directed to do so by the presenter. It can be distracting for others. So without further ado, I'm going to turn the session over to Peggy Greenwell with the U.S. Access Board, and she will introduce our speaker and moderate today's session. Peggy, go ahead.
Okay, thanks Robin, and welcome everyone to our session on accessible detention and correctional facilities. It's my pleasure to once again introduce Dave Yanchulis. He is a long-term accessibility specialist here at the board. He's been here since 1988, and he is expert in almost every area of the accessibility standards and specifically worked on the rulemaking years ago when we were dealing with correctional facilities. So before I turn it over to Dave, I just wanted to add on to what Robin mentioned about questions. We'll give you instructions again about entering them into the chat area, but we won't be able to respond to the questions until the end of the presentation, but we will have time at the end to respond to those questions. Additionally, people did submit some questions in advance, and Dave is going to be incorporating those questions and answers into the presentation as he goes along. So without further hesitation, I'm going to turn it over to Dave.
Thanks, Peggy, and thanks everyone for joining us today. We are going to focus today on the requirements for detention and correctional facilities contained in the recently published ADA Standards 2010 edition, as well as standards that are applicable to federal facilities. What we're going to cover today is a review of provisions and exceptions in the standards that are unique to these types of facilities, including common use areas used by inmates and detainees, as well as accessible cells. We'll be talking about both the minimum number of cells required as well as the technical specifications for cells. And we'll also address requirements for visiting areas and end the session with a question and answer segment. Next slide. So the new ADA standards, which the Department of Justice adopted and made effective last spring, now contain requirements, both scoping and technical, for detention and correctional facilities. These standards are based on guidelines previously issued by the board and are unique in that they clearly address these kind of facilities. Previous editions of the standards really had little or nothing to say about detention and correctional facilities. As many of you no doubt know by now, these standards became mandatory last March, March 15th, and they apply to all new construction and alterations covered by the ADA. Next slide. Now then, in addition to the ADA standards, we also have requirements that apply to federally funded facilities under an earlier law, the Architectural Barriers Act. So a lot of the material we're covering today is relevant both to provisions in the ADA standards as well as those in the companion Architectural Barriers Act or ABA standards. But if you're dealing with state or local government facilities, then you would be subject to the ADA standards, the 2010 edition. Federal facilities, on the other hand, federal prisons and the like, they would actually be subject to the ABA standards, which were implemented by the General Services Administration in 2006. But I would point out that in the coverage of detention and correctional facilities, these standards are very much the same. There are some differences, and we'll talk about this later, with scoping for accessible cells. But a lot of the exceptions, unique provisions that we'll be talking about today can be found in both standards. And for the most part, the numbering system is the same. So some of the cited provisions would most likely be the same number in either document. Slide 7. So detention and correctional facilities, what do we mean by them? These are facilities where people are detained for penal or correctional purposes or in which the liberty of the inmates is restricted for security reasons. That is defined that way in the actual standards, but the terms here are intended to encompass all types of detention facilities. That would include jails, whether county or local city. Holding cells in police stations would also be an example of a detention facility, and a wider range of other types are covered for are provided for correctional purposes, including reformatories, prisons, both adult and juvenile facilities. So any kind of facility where a government entity is incarcerating people is likely covered by these provisions. Now, some people have asked whether a prison or detention facility that's built by a private entity and operated on behalf of a government through a contract or licensing is covered. And yes, such facilities are fully covered like any other public entity would be covered by these standards. Basically, it's only a government entity that, for the most part, has authority to incarcerate individuals for violations of law or other reasons. And so any kind of facility, even if it's privately built or privately operated, if it's doing so by or on behalf of a government entity, then it's fully covered as a detention and correctional facilities under the ADA. Slide 8. So what we're going to cover first today is a review of provisions in the standards that are specific to these kind of facilities. Now, with the particularly with the latest edition of the standards, the effort has been made to really integrate requirements so that they apply no matter what kind of facility you're dealing with. And so a lot of provisions that are unique to a certain type of occupancy, including prisons, are now found throughout the document. We do have a subsection that's devoted to holding cells, but there's a lot of other provisions that are relevant that are located outside that section. So when we go through these provisions, you will see on the slide where the provision is located, just in case you want to track back to it and find the actual text. But the provisions we'll be talking about today address entrances and doors, general exceptions, vertical access, means of egress, and various elements including drinking fountains, signs, telephones, and of course holding and housing cells. Slide 9. Now with respect to entrances, a prison correctional facility would be fully subject to requirements for public entrances. They specify at least 60% being accessible in new construction. But in addition to that, at least one entrance that's provided for use by detainees and inmates would have to be accessible. And that this would apply to all components of the entrance. So whatever entrance is secured entrance is provided for inmates and detainees to enter the facility, at least one would have to be accessible. Also, there's a requirement in the standards that if you have a restricted entrance, then at least one must be accessible. And that would be maybe, say, for example, an entrance that's limited only to certain groups of users, maybe employees or certain subgroups of employees. So if you have that kind of entrance, then that's not serving inmates or detainees, one restricted entrance would have to be accessible as well. Slide 10. Now, entrance doors, as well as any door in the interior, are required to be accessible along accessible routes. But we do have some exceptions for doors that are manually operated only by security personnel. And in this case, if a door is only operated by security personnel, then it's not required to comply with provisions governing hardware in Section 404, the door section, or closing speed or opening force. All other provisions, including thresholds, clear width, maneuvering clearance, would still apply. And in the case of automatic doors, the only requirements one needs to meet if it's operated by security personnel would be the clear width and the threshold requirements. Slide 11. Now, in providing access to entrances and doors, it's important that the connecting accessible route not be obstructed, confined, or reduced in any way. You must have at least a continuous clear width of 3 feet along accessible routes. It's permitted to reduce to a 32-inch clear width at points for a maximum distance of 2 feet. So if you have, say, for example, security bollards or other types of barriers that confine routes to an entrance, it's important to make sure that they don't infringe upon the clear width of the accessible route needed to an accessible entrance. Slide 12. The standards in the entrance section scoping also address routes around security screening devices, including metal detectors. And so if you have such a device at an accessible entrance, the accessible route must run through or around the detector so that people with disabilities can independently proceed through an entrance, including the security checkpoints. Slide 13. In the standards, we also have requirements for communication devices, two-way communication devices that may be provided at an entrance to a facility, usually a restricted type of entrance. And if one's provided, the standards require that you have both visual and audible signals so that people with sensory impairments can utilize the communication, make communication to gain entry. Slide 14. Now there are a couple exceptions, overall exceptions in the standards that are relevant to detention and correctional facilities. One of them is a general exception. This would be in Section 203.3 that says that if you have areas raised primarily for purposes of security, such as a guard tower, or life or fire safety, then that structure is not required to be accessible or to be on an accessible route. So here what you see in the slide is an image of a prison guard tower. That tower, the whole tower, and the route to it, including the entrance to the tower, would not have to comply under this exception. Slide 15. Now, this exception is not limited to independent structures or towers. It's also applicable to different types of spaces, including interior spaces, that are raised because they're used by personnel to monitor detainees and inmates. So the key factors here is that the space or structure has to be raised, and in the case of these kind of facilities, for security purposes. So certain monitoring stations in prisons and jails that have to be raised would be subject to this exception. Now, we did get a question in advance of today's session about other types of employee use spaces. For example, there may be spaces not used for monitoring inmates or detainees or for security that are used only by employees for work. And those types of spaces, under the ADA standards, those types of spaces aren't exempt. They have to be on an accessible route for approach, entry, and exit, but they're not required to be fully accessible. So if you maybe had, for example, a room where maybe evidence or other personal belongings are stored by employees and are not used by inmates or detainees, and other types of workspaces, they would have to be accessible for approach, entry, and exit. But other elements and spaces within the work area, if used only by employees for work, would not have to comply. Keep in mind that this limited level of access for employee work areas in ADA facilities applies only to areas used for work. Other areas not used for work by employees, like restrooms, employee lounges, locker rooms, have to be fully accessible. Slide 16. We're going to proceed to review some other exceptions for detention and correctional facilities, but what I would like to point out is that a lot of these exceptions are applicable only to inmate and detainee use areas and not to public use areas. So it's important to keep in mind that the provisions that are unique to the security areas used by inmates or detainees, we expect public use areas to be fully compliant. We not only expect it, we require it. What we mean in this context by public use areas are spaces, elements available for members of the public. In the case of a prison, for example, a lot of this traffic we're speaking of that's public would be visitors, maybe to visit inmates or detainees. Those areas used by the public, such as entrances, lobbies, public restrooms, the visitor side of visitation spaces, those are typically what would be considered public use in a prison or jail facility. Many other types of spaces, however, are used only by inmates or detainees or security personnel, would not be considered public use and would likely or could qualify for some of these exceptions we're going to talk about. And I would point out, too, that if you have certain types of traffic, say, for example, people that are arriving or are visiting the facility to provide services on the prisoner or jail operator's behalf, maybe it's medical services or education or therapy, I would not consider that kind of traffic public or making that area a public use area. That would more likely be considered a common use area. So again, when we talk about certain provisions not applicable to public use areas, we're talking about the broader range of potential traffic from among members of the public. Slide 17. Now, another exception we have for detention and correctional facilities concerns common use areas that serve inmates and detainees. A lot of prisons are designed and configured with more of a pod type layout, where you have a certain subset of cells being served by particular common use areas. And we've provided an exception in this scenario where the common use area that's limited to a certain group of cells doesn't have to be accessible if there are no accessible cells it serves or in that pod. And the type of common use areas we're talking about could range. The common one is the day room and the cells arrayed around it. But that also could be true for maybe bathing facilities and other types of spaces that are available for inmate or detainee use. Now, the limitation on this exception is that we're dealing with a common use area that's only usable by occupants of a certain group of cells. Slide 18. Now, if you have additional common use areas, which is often the case, that serve all cells or serve accessible cells, they have to be compliant. For example, you might have cafeteria or exercise yards, educational facilities, and the like. And often, those types of areas serve not just individual pods of cells, but a broader range of the cells on a site. So the important thing is to make sure that all common use areas that are serving accessible cells are in fact accessible, because the exception is not going to apply to any common use area that's serving accessible cells. But we included this exception because this detention and correctional environments are unique in the sense that they often restrict use of certain spaces to certain portions of the user population. Slide 19. Now, elements provided in common use areas required to be accessible must comply. And this would include dining, work surfaces that are fixed, drinking fountains, phones, etc., whatever is provided. Elements like this are not required by the standards, but the accessibility provisions are applying where they are provided. And again, keep in mind that with the way application works of the standards, we're really relying on all relevant provisions in the standard being met. So again, you want to be sure that when you're dealing with common use areas, that all relevant provisions, specifications, and standards are followed. So for example, if it's a cafeteria that's required to be accessible, then you want to make sure that not only just dining, but food service lines, queues, and other elements covered in the standards are met. And same is true for if you're providing drinking fountains or work surfaces and the like. Slide 20. Now, with respect to drinking fountains, these standards require that you provide dual access, so that access is provided for people who are seated in a mobility aid as well as people who stand. Both types of access are required. If you only have one unit provided within a secured area, then you would need to provide both types of access, either through high-low separate units or combo high-low units. Where drinking fountains are provided, including within the secured areas, dual access is required. If you have multiple units provided, then we require half to be wheelchair accessible and the other half to be designed for use by people who are standing. But there is an exception, and if drinking fountains that only serve inaccessible cells are not required to comply, either with the access, the high or the low access. Slide 21. The standards also address telephones, including TTYs, and in section 217.4, there is a provision specifically for detention and correctional facilities. And that requires that if you have at least one payphone provided in a secured area for inmate or detainee use, then at least one TTY must be provided. And the way the standards address access, TTY access, they're really calling for a permanent integrated unit into the phone. If you provide payphones in a public use area, like a entrance lobby, then the standards would additionally require that at least one TTY be accessible for public use. We did get a question in advance of the session asking about whether this requirement applies to different secured areas or to the site overall. And the way the requirement is written, it's requiring only one TTY for the site for the secured areas. We would recommend that in large facilities, it would be better in achieving communication access to exceed that if you're providing where payphones are provided. But the standards technically only require one TTY in a secured area if a payphone is provided in that location. Now, in addition to TTYs, other requirements for phones, including wheelchair access and volume control, apply. And unlike the TTY requirements, the wheelchair access and volume control requirements are not limited to pay telephones, but are applied to different types of phones that are provided and are permanently installed. In the case of wheelchair access, the standards require that wheelchair access be provided at each bank of phones provided where banks of phones are provided. If only single unit phones are provided, then it's one per floor. And volume control is required for all phones. Slide 22. Now, we do have some provisions that address vertical access in detention and correctional facilities. And these are found in this the section covering scoping for accessible routes in section 206, specifically 206.2.3, where you have some exceptions relevant to vertical access between stories. And vertical access is required only as necessary to provide an accessible route to accessible cells, all common use areas serving accessible cells, and of course all public use areas on a site. Slide 23. The exception allows that it or stipulates that vertical access is not required to levels or stories without accessible cells or public or common use spaces required to be accessible. So often in many prison designs, you may have a common use area like a day room with tiers of cells surrounding it. So under this exception, if you provide your accessible cells on the lower level and the only thing on the upper tiers or levels are inaccessible cells, but no common use areas required to be accessible or serving accessible cells, then vertical access to those levels would not be required. Slide 24. We also have an exception for stairways, and this can be found in section 210.1. We exempt stairs from compliance in non-public spaces. Part of the reason for this is that in secured areas and in locations used by inmates or detainees, for security purposes, they don't like the closed risers. Designers prefer open risers. And our requirements the requirements for stairs prohibit the open risers. So that and some other criteria related to handrails is why you have this exception. But again, it's applicable only to stairs in non-public use spaces. Slide 25. The standards require an address means of egress through a reference to the International Building Code and the provisions in that document for means of egress, including accessible means of egress. So we would expect that the IBC be followed as appropriate for detention and correctional facilities, as well as any other type of facility. However, in the ADA standards and the ABA standards, we do have an exception that says that even if otherwise required, areas of refuge are not required in detention and correctional facilities. And the reason for this exception is that these types of spaces go against some certain security considerations, and because, which is so often the case, evacuation is controlled and monitored. So areas of refuge not required in detention and correctional facilities. Slide 26. We also don't require signs to comply in non-public spaces. The reason for this exception is that prison operators are concerned about objects, materials that could be removed from walls, including race characters and the like. So the standards in their call for race characters in Braille for certain types of room labels could pose some hazards in secured areas. So we only require signs in public use areas to comply. Slide 27. So before wrapping up with the common use areas, I just wanted to kind of recap some of what we just talked about. Now here on the screen you see what is a pretty typical type of day room common use area serving a pod of cells. And in this image, you see some examples of some of the exempt spaces and elements we talked about. That would include in the background the stairs serving the tiers, and those tiers, if the upper tier is only containing inaccessible cells, the stairs don't have to comply, nor do you need vertical access. In the back corner, you see a raised security area for monitoring use of the space by inmates. That too would not have to comply, nor would the signs in the space. But elements covered and not exempt would include fixed tables and seating, phones, and drinking fountains. Now, keep in mind the overall exception for common use areas. If this day room did not serve any accessible cells, then nothing in it would have to be compliant. But if there were accessible cells on the perimeter served by it, then of course the elements you see, most of which are in the foreground, would have to comply. Slide 28. I'd like to move on and talk about the minimum requirements for accessible cells, including holding cells and housing cells. Slide 29. Now the requirements, the ADA standards are heavily derived from the board's minimum guidelines, but we have some key changes and increases in accessibility here in this section for scoping for holding and housing cells. So it's important to be sure you're consulting for ADA facilities, DOJ standards. They include enhanced scoping and dispersion requirements for accessible cells. And as printed by the Department of Justice, these standards can provide the provisions, additional provisions for detention and correctional facilities in the beginning, pages 13 and 14, at section 35.151, paragraph K. So be sure to check out that section in verifying what the minimum requirements are for the amount of cells that must be accessible. slide 30. The DOJ's ADA standards require that at least 3%, and no fewer than one, of holding or housing cells be accessible for mobility access. And the accessible cells must be distributed in each classification level. Now, we did get some questions as about what is meant by classification level. It's really intended to apply to any kind of categorization of housing or security. So often it's pertinent to security level, but it also housing can also be distinguished by maybe short-term, long-term. You might have, say, for example, a county facility that is both a detention facility like a jail, but that also has services provided for correctional needs, functioning as a prison. In that kind of environment, we would regard the short-term detention facility and the longer-term correctional as separate types of classifications, and the standards would require access in both types. But if you have also different classifications by medium, low security, maximum security, the standards would ensure that accessible cells are provided in each. Now, the distribution among classifications doesn't have to be proportionate, but you have to be sure that accessible cells are distributed in each type. Now, with respect to federal facilities, the standards originally called for 2%, but the Department of Justice indicates that its Bureau of Prisons and the design guidelines federal prisons are subject to currently call for 3% as well. So for consistency, Department of Justice for ADA purposes called for 3% and acknowledges that federal prisons are subject to the same level. But that's not in the ABA standards. That's actually in Bureau of Prison Design Guidelines. If you do look it up in the ABA standards, don't be confused by seeing the 2%. If you're dealing with a federal prison, verify whatever requirements apply through the Bureau of Prisons in determining the minimum number. Slide 31. Now, the standards also apply in alterations, and here, too, DOJ has added additional information in its standards. They're requiring the 3% or no fewer than one to altered cells, and this would be based on the total number of cells altered, not necessarily the total provided on the site, although it could be advisable to go with the number required for the full amount, but the minimum is based on the total number of cells altered, and the 3% equally applies. But DOJ did add some provisions that indicate when it would be permissible to provide access to substitute cells on the same site. And this was addressing the fact that sometimes when you alter or undertaking alterations for certain cells, there may be certain factors outside the scope of the project that impact or limit accessibility. And in some situations where it would be preferable and improve access to provide, to make other types of cells accessible, that may be possible. But certain factors must be met. If you do provide access to substitute cells, they must be integrated with other holding or housing cells. They can't be really separated from all other cells. Also, it's important that the occupants of the substitute cells have equal access to all available programs and services that are available to inmates or detainees within that classification level. And the substitute cells have to be located on the same prison or jail site. But DOJ is allowing potentially a location on another site within the correction system only if it's technically infeasible to make cells, including substitute cells, accessible on the site that's actually being altered. And this is trying to be responsive to certain conditions where some operators have expressed concern that within the existing system and collection of prison sites, even if some access is provided through an alteration, there may be other parts of the facility, other barriers that really preclude access to various programs and services. So if it's not technically feasible to provide fully accessible cells on a site, then it may be possible to provide substitute access on other sites in the correction system. Slide 32. Now, we also have a requirement for special use cells as opposed to general holding or housing cells. These are cells that are really designed, intended to serve a particular purpose. For example, disciplinary detention or segregation, protective custody, orientation, detoxification, medical isolation. Any of these cells, at least access is required to at least one cell of each type. Now, if a cell does serve multiple purposes, maybe there's a cell that's used for both detoxification and medical isolation, for example, then access could be provided just to that cell in order to provide access to those type of uses. So we don't prohibit a cell from serving multiple purposes if it's viable from a design standpoint. But the important thing is to make sure that each type of cell, special use cell, there's access to at least one. Slide 33. We also have scoping requirements for cells that provide communication access. Now, these requirements are slightly lower. It's a 2% scoping, not 3%. And it's applicable only when you have cells that are served by audible emergency alarm systems, meaning the occupants of the cell are served by the alarm, and they have permanently installed telephones. This is not very common. So this provision, in many cases, may not apply because you may not have cells that where the occupants are directly served by an alarm system or are equipped with telephones. A lot of times, telephones are provided outside the cell in a common use area. So in that situation, the provision here would not be triggered. And we also require that If you do have a facility subject to this scoping provision, we don't require compliance with the alarm requirements if the inmates or detainees are not permitted independent means of evacuation. There may be we have it in here just because there may be some low security types of facilities where it may be possible that inmates or detainees are expected to independently evacuate maybe a building on the site. And that's why we really included this provision. But there's for many types of sites or facilities, it may likely not be triggered. Slide 34. Now, medical care facilities provided in a prison or correctional facility are fully covered as medical care facilities. And in fact, in implementing the standards, DOJ added clarification that the requirements in the standards for medical care and long-term care facilities apply to whether or not a facility is licensed on a prison or detention facility site. So when you have medical facilities provided, we would look to the scoping, for example, 10% minimum for patient bedrooms, being met in the medical care section of a jail or prison. It's important that facilities be designed so that regular holding and housing cells are accessible in addition to any medical care facilities. It's not permitted to house inmates with disabilities in a medical care facility if they don't otherwise would not be located in that area of the prison. And so if it's due to a lack of access, that would not be acceptable under DOJ's regulations and standards. So it's important that, especially in new construction, that the proper access be met in regular housing and holding cells so that there's no effort being made to house inmates or detainees with disabilities in medical facilities without a appropriate medical reason. Slide 35. Now we're going to look at some of the technical requirements for accessible cells, be they holding cells or housing cells. A lot of these provisions are applying based on what's provided. Now, for an accessible cell, you must have turning space. That's true for all accessible wheelchair-accessible cells. Benches must comply only where they're provided, and we have requirements for beds that apply where provided. And toilet and bathing facilities serving accessible cells also must be fully compliant. Slide 36. Yeah. So for holding and housing cells, if benches are provided, at least one bench must be accessible. And that includes the clear floor space adjacent to the bench, the bench height and dimensions, 42 inches long minimum, 20 to 24 inches deep, as well as the criteria for back support. Now, some holding cells may be equipped with benches, and that's where this would be applicable. We would also require the turning circle, and the turning circle can partially overlap the clear floor space required within a cell. And doors would also be required to comply, but as we noted earlier, if they're operated only by security personnel, they're not required to meet certain provisions for door hardware, opening force, and closing space. Now, I did get some questions in advance about whether benches are required in certain locations. For example, are benches required in toilet or bathing facilities, or are they required in cells, housing cells, because that's where users would be expected to change clothes. And under the standards, requirements for benches are limited to dressing, fitting, and locker rooms. So we don't require benches in bathing facilities otherwise, and we don't require them in housing or holding cells. These provisions are applying where they are provided. Slide 37. Housing cells are going to have beds, and we require that access to at least one bed, and this means the clear floor space, wheelchair space, for a parallel approach is provided aside the bed. If you have dormitory style or barrack style type of sleeping rooms with many beds, if we require at least 5% of beds to be accessible if more than 25 beds are provided in a room. Otherwise, it's at least one. Now, we often get questions about bed height, both in this type of facility and other types of facilities, and the standards don't specify a height for beds. We recommend a height to the surface, sleeping surface, from the floor to be 17 to 19 inches. That is consistent with the height we require for toilet seats, benches, and other types of seating. But that is a recommendation. It's not a requirement. And we don't have a minimum clearance requirement in the case of bunk style beds, but we would advise that consideration be given to providing a proper clearance that doesn't interfere with transfer from a mobility aid where an upper bunk is provided, or for access purposes, it would be best that an upper bunk not be provided at an accessible bed. Slide 38. Now, other fixed elements provided in cells must comply when made available for use by detainees and inmates. This would include fixed writing surfaces or desks, storage elements. So keep in mind that even though something might not be specifically called out in the subsection for holding cells, if it's covered by the standards and provided for occupants of the cell, then it's covered as well. Slide 39. I'd like to talk a little bit about toilet facilities and bathing facilities. A lot of questions we do get about cells concern these kind of features. And I just want to start out kind of recapping what's required for any accessible toilet, because for the most part, we've not provided any exceptions from the requirements for toilet facilities. So the expectation is that a toilet serving an accessible holding or housing cell, is going to be fully compliant. That's the requirement. And this would include, of course, the location of the fixture. And under the new standards, the center line is permitted to be 16 to 18 inches from the closest sidewall. We're requiring grab bars both on the side and the rear wall. And the water closet clearance must be at least 56 inches deep and 60 inches wide for a toilet not located in a stall. Slide 40. Now, under the new standards, lavatories can no longer overlap the clearance at water closets. And this is now true for toilets and lavs serving holding and housing cells. This was changed in the standards so that there'd be more transfer options and approach options at accessible water closets. Slide 41. Now, the clearance at the lav can overlap the water closet clearance. It's just the fixture itself that can't. And the lavatory must be at least 17 inches deep, measured horizontally from the wall or support, so that there's adequate knee and toe clearance below the element. Slide 42. So a lot of people ask whether combination toilet and lav units are acceptable. And the shorter answer is yes, if they're meeting all applicable requirements. We don't forgive anything for a combination unit. If a combination unit is not going to meet the standards, then it's important to go with separate fixtures. But combination units that are available that fully meet the standards are perfectly acceptable for ADA purposes. Now, it's important, though, that the combination unit have the proper grab bars, both the side and the rear, that the toilet complies, including the seat height and flush controls, location from sidewall, the lavatory must be fully compliant, including the knee and toe space. Slide 43. So for a combination unit to be compliant, it needs to have the lav located outside the clearance of the toilet. We did get a question about whether some models are acceptable that, in effect, have a rear grab bar that is slightly shifted closer to the sidewall. And there isn't a specific exception for combination units or this grab bar, but there is a general exception that's permitted when you recess a fixture, like a lavatory, at toilets to keep it outside the water closet clearance. And this exception, which is in the section on toilets, section 604, says that if you recess a fixture at a water closet, you are permitted to have a 24-inch grab bar instead of what needs to be a 36-inch grab bar. And that was done to facilitate recessing of fixtures to be outside the toilet water clearance. In light of that exception, I think that it would be permissible as an equivalent facilitation if, say, you're looking at a combination unit that has sufficient grab bars but maybe are shifted slightly closer to the wall, because otherwise the grab bar must be 3 feet long minimum, and that grab bar must be positioned so that it covers at least 12 inches on the closed side of the water closet measured from the water closet center line, and 24 inches minimum on the open side. But elements or products out there that pretty much have the 3 foot grab bar but have shifted slightly, I think under the exception we see for a shorter grab bar recess fixtures, even though in this situation the lav might not be technically reassessed, I think would be acceptable as an equivalent facilitation. Slide 44. Now, keep in mind that the requirements for lavatories also fully apply to that portion of the combination unit, and that would include the wheelchair space, typically 30 by 48 inches minimum, for a forward approach at the fixture. And this space must underlap the lavatory by at least 17 inches so that you have that minimum 17-inch depth of knee and toe space achieved. Here you're seeing the space oriented for an approach in this forward, but you could also, because of the way the lav is positioned, but some, like in the earlier slide, you saw that the lav was actually turned for approach from the side. Either one's acceptable as long as you have the knee and toe space for a forward approach. That's going to apply no matter which way the bowl is oriented. Slide 45. Grab bars at toilets are required to comply, but in cells specially designed without protrusions for suicide prevention, we do provide an exception. But keep in mind that this exception is not permitted regular holding or housing cells. That's permitted only when you have a cell that is specially designed without any types of projections, protrusions from walls. In that case, the grab bars don't have to be provided. Now, in other locations where grab bars are required, we don't prohibit the use of infill plates, but it's important that if they're provided as a guard against any kind of suicide attempt, that they be designed so that they don't obstruct the gripping surface of the grab bar. So it is possible, as long as they don't compromise the usability of the grab bar, to go with an infill plate. But I understand too that there's been some concerns about the infill plate because they really kind of provide a hiding area for contraband. So there may be some trade-offs in going this route. But my point here is that their infiltrate is not specifically prohibited by the standards or the regulations. Slide 46. And as with toilets, for bathing facilities, we apply the standards with really no exceptions. We expect that, you know, whatever type of element is provided, you have your choice in providing access in bathing facilities to a transfer type of shower stall, a roll-in shower stall, or a tub. At least one element bathing unit must be accessible, no matter which type it is. And we are requiring full compliance with grab bars, controls. And if you have a transfer type of shower, the 3 foot by 3 foot stall, then we do require the folding seat be provided. If we don't prohibit access being provided in gang type showers, but again, all the applicable criteria, including the grab bars, must be satisfied. And as I noted earlier, we don't require benches other than required shower seats in bathing facilities. Slide 47. There is one exception relevant to bathing facilities, and that concerns the handheld shower spray unit. At accessible showers, we do require that you have a handheld shower spray, but in detention and correctional facilities and other types of facilities where vandalism may be a concern, where they may be misused or abused, then we do permit a fixed shower head, 48 inches maximum, above the floor being provided instead of the handheld unit. Slide 48. And wrapping up today, we're going to just review the requirements for visiting areas. We require that in visiting areas, including non-contact visiting, that you provide access both on the visitor side and the inmate or detainee side. And where it's counters, then we require at least one. If you have more of a type of a cubicle configuration, it's 5%. But access would be required in each visiting area. But we do have an exception saying that if a visiting area is not serving any the occupants of any accessible cells, then the inmate or detainee side doesn't need to comply. But it would still have to comply on the visitor side. And we also require that where security glazing is provided, that you also include a method to facilitate voice communication. This could be a grill, talk-through baffle. It doesn't have to be a handset, but if a handset is provided, then we require that it include volume control. Slide 49. And with non-contact visiting areas, there's sometimes concerns about having a movable piece of furniture temporarily overlap the clear floor space and accessible counter. We do permit fixed swing away types of seats that if there's a concern about security concern about a non-fixed seating. But the important thing there is that it be independently usable and that it fully clear the wheelchair space, the minimum 30 by 48 inches required for a forward approach at the counter. Slide 50. So what we covered today in the webinar was pretty focused on the design requirements contained in the ADA standards and for federal facilities, the ABA standards. But it's important to keep in mind that other requirements, responsibilities, and obligations of the ADA apply, including to prisons and correctional facilities and detention facilities that address program access, services, prohibit discrimination in policies, procedures, and these requirements lie outside the standards. But in updating the standards and its regulations, DOJ did add some provisions specific to prison systems because DOJ found that in its casework and investigation of complaints that there was more often than not very serious problems with accessibility in this kind of environment. And so keep in mind that for full compliance, it's not just designing, building a compliant building, but it's also ensuring that there's full access to the all available programs and services at a facility. Facility operators also have a responsibility under the ADA to make reasonable modifications. Similar requirements apply also to federal prisons. And there's also obligations to ensure effective communication. So even though we saw earlier about certain requirements that apply for, you know, phones and TTYs, in addition to that, there are responsibilities to ensure effective communication. And they could be relevant to various types of communication. Two-way video-based remote type of visitation may be becoming more common. And so even though that's something not addressed in the design standards, it is still something that needs to be made available in a way that accommodates users with disabilities. But in DOJ's updated ADA regulations, section 35.151, you will see some of these additional requirements that have been provided for operators of detention and correctional facilities. And so, for example, they've indicated that it's not permissible to locate inmates or detainees with disabilities in a security classification merely because there's no accessible cells or accessible beds available. It has to be due based on the regular appropriate reasons, not due to a lack of accessibility. It's also important that inmates or detainees with disabilities not be located in medical facilities unless they're actually receiving medical care. So DOJ has actually stipulated that in the regs. And it's also important that the system operate so as to not be discriminatory in, say, ability for family or friends to visit inmates or detainees with disabilities, such as may happen when one is housed in a more distant facility, maybe due to lack of access elsewhere. So that's an important part of this picture, is the program component when we're talking about detention and correctional facilities. But we at the board can provide further guidance and address questions only as they pertain to design and construction. So with that, I'd like to just kind of see what questions we may have gotten during the session.
And let's give Dave a chance to catch his breath here. On that note that Dave was just discussing, the requirements for program accessibility and other requirements in the regulation, some of you have asked some questions that really pertain to those types of issues. And as Dave mentioned, those are really not within our purview. So we would encourage you to contact the Department of Justice for further guidance on those areas, what to do when you may not have enough accessibility provided in your facility, and other questions related to that. If you do design your facility, of course, all of these standards do apply to newly constructed and altered facilities. So in the Department of Justice's technical assistance hotline is 800-514-0301. That's 800-514-0301. So that would be the place to get your answers to some of these program accessibility questions. And so you've been submitting some questions along the way here. Dave, I think, might be ready to jump into some of those. And so I'm going to turn it back over to him.
Thanks, Peggy. Yes, we did get some very good, helpful questions come in, and I'm going to run through some of them now. One question is about doors, and this person asked about whether or not a door that's operated by security personnel must still meet maneuvering clearance requirements. Yes, doors operated by security personnel still must meet the requirements for maneuvering clearance. The reason we did not provide an exception from this requirement is that the maneuvering clearance that's provided at a door is not only benefiting the additional space in opening the door, but also maneuvering through. So we didn't want to run into problems with inadequate maneuvering clearance at a door merely because it's operated by security personnel. The maneuvering clearances help make sure that you have enough space to get through the door based on the approach. We also had a question. We were talking earlier about stairways, and we noted that a stairway in a non-public use area is exempt. And the question was asked, is the vertical clearance, reduced vertical clearance below a stair, open stair, relevant? That is still covered by the standards. The exception we give you is only for the stairs. We don't exempt protruding objects or reduced clearances. So even if you have a stair in a non-public space, even though it doesn't have to meet the stair requirements, it would still need to be properly treated as in terms of the underside area that has a reduced clearance. Specifically, what we talk about there in the standards is some kind of detectable barrier alerting people to the fact that the vertical clearance is dropping below the 80-inch minimum. We also had a question about large facilities with a sizable number of disciplinary or segregation cells. If it's a cell that's has a special purpose, and disciplinary detention or segregation, protective custody, like those special uses, we only require at least one. Now, in large facilities where you have many types of these cells, we would recommend applying with the 3%. But the way the standards are written, the 3% is applying only to general housing and holding cells, not special use. We also had a question about upper bunks and how they impact use of lower bunks. Actually, we don't really have good information on the impacts, but we just would want people to be mindful that in addition to space at the bed for positioning and transfer from a mobility aid, that you not have a low obstruction that could impair or cause problems when one is transferring from the mobility aid onto the bed. So I think that, we don't really have a good specific measurement, but we just encourage people to make sure that you're maximizing the clearance above the accessible bed or avoiding any kind of issue altogether by just not having an upper bunk above an accessible bed. And then we had a question about tissue holders at combination units. This question pertained to certain types of combination units, toilet lavatory combination units that may not have a toilet paper dispenser, and in fact may have storage location that holds a roll of toilet paper, usually in the kind of base of the unit. The question was, you know, if this is not a dispenser, is a toilet paper dispenser actually required? The way the standards are written, there's an expectation that a toilet paper dispenser is provided, but the standards actually say that toilet paper dispensers be located as we specify in the standards. So if the question is that can a combination or other type of toilet lavatory be provided without a toilet paper dispenser, I assume perhaps because maybe some dispensers are provide any kind of hazard, then that would not be a violation of the standards. But we would recommend that for the inaccessible toilets that a toilet paper dispenser be provided. If you have that tissue holder location in the combination unit, I would agree that's not technically a dispenser, it's storage, but it would still have to be within accessible reach range. And I would recommend that one give consideration to usability, because that's what it's really going to come down to. So it's one thing to have, you know, storage for a roll of toilet paper that's within accessible reach, but it's another thing to, you know, factor in, you know, usability in dispensing toilet paper. And if a actual dispenser is not being provided for security reasons, what else can be done to ensure usability by people with disabilities? And we had a question about video phones and their use over TTYs. And the standard
line muted.
The standards don't address this specifically, but we're just calling for TTYs where payphones are provided. And if you use some other kind of means of providing video-based communication, DOJ regs and provisions for effective communication are going to ensure that people with disabilities are adequately accommodated based on the type provided. And we had another question about, can you use a removable shower seat in a transfer shower? You would have to really rely on equivalent facilitation. I'm sorry, we ran into some interference. I hope everyone could still hear me. But in the question we got about a removable shower seat, the standards...
Line unmuted.
Yeah, the standards do basically call for a fixed shower seat in a transfer shower, which can be folding. It has to be properly secured for safety. So in general, it's not allowed to use a removable shower seat in a transfer stall. It has to be properly secured. And we also had a question about if the security level precludes an inmate with a disability from being housed in a particular unit, does the housing unit still need to meet all ADA requirements? I'm not sure if the question is getting at whether there's an expectation that people with disabilities will not be located in a certain category of or classification of security. I would be cautious about that. When the board was developing these requirements and the input we got from corrections officials and prison operators, the consensus seemed to be that more often than not, you can't assume that a person with a disability won't be housed in a certain level of security. And so in new construction, I think it's, you know, safest to make sure you're meeting what DOJ specifically called for, which was that accessible cells be located in each classification level, but you could certainly distribute more in one type than another, but it's still required that you provide access at least one in each type of category. And we got a question about what is required in conjugal visit facilities. Well, here we would make sure that you just have equal access at least to the space, so that as any other kind of common use space, visiting area, that it be on an accessible route, and that all elements within, including entrances and any other elements provided in the space, are fully accessible. And I would say that contact visitation facilities, it's important that all of them be accessible. You know, we had that exception we talked about where common use area serving inaccessible cells only don't have to comply. But with contact visitation, because it's fully serving visitors from the public, it's important that access be provided to each in the case of contact visitation facilities. And I think that wraps it up for our questions.
It appears that we have a little bit more time, so if anybody wants to submit an additional question, we're happy to try to address it. Otherwise, we'll... Okay, it looks like a question has come in about the space required between the grab bar and the wall.
Yes.
Yeah.
We did get a question about the grab bar mounted on the face of a combination unit, and question about whether the trim of the dispenser unit into the knuckle clearance required behind the grab bar poses a problem. I would say that yes, if you're going to have any kind of intrusion into that, reducing that clearance, that would be a problem. The other thing I would point out too is that when we're looking at the grab bar mounted on the face of a combination unit, the grab bar height really has to be at the 33-inch minimum, because the surface height, counter height at the lavatory has to be at 34 inches maximum. So to have really, for it to work, you're really looking at the grab bar being located at the lower range of the height specified. And then we have a question about the use of sign language interpreters when an inmate or detainee is receiving medical care. Sign language interpretation and other requirements concerning communication that are not design-based are covered by DOJ's regulations, and we at the Access Board would have to defer to the Department of Justice or to the National ADA Network on questions unrelated to design. There was a question, too, about if you have a telephone handset, whether the telephone cord, length of cord is addressed. And although previous editions of the standards address phone cord length, the new ones no longer address a minimum. Well, they have the 29-inch length, I'm sorry. They do have a 29-inch minimum length, and that would be applicable at wheelchair-accessible phones. But for visitation, non-contact visitation, we don't apply the cord length requirement. We just apply the volume control. So wheelchair-accessible phones in other areas other than non-contact visitation would be subject to the phone cord length, but not at non-contact visitation. and
holding cells in judicial facilities. Yeah.
We had another question here about courthouse facilities,
mm-hmm.
and we basically are applying very similar requirements to detention facilities, holding cells, and in judicial facilities. There's not really much substantive difference.
They wanted more examples of public use areas versus secured areas used only by detainees or inmates.
In the case of detention and correctional facilities, public use areas really have to, what we're trying to get at there would be facilities that are open to visitors from the public. So again, we're looking at public entrances, public lobbies, visiting areas. Now, other areas that the exceptions we talked about where we said non-public, okay, that would mean pretty much a lot of areas in a prison or correctional facility, that would mean the areas where the public cannot go. And my only point, too, is that certain limited type of traffic, like people who are visiting to provide service or programs to inmates or detainees, like instructors, like clergy, like medical staff, that type of use area would not be public. That would be considered common use. So your type of traffic has to be broader than that for it to be considered public use, because public use means pretty much members of the public can use that space. When it's restricted to a certain group of users, that's considered common use. And the reason we don't really base exceptions on, quote, a secured space is because what is secured in a prison could encompass both public and non-public areas. So we tried to clarify it in the standards that only the non-public spaces get certain exceptions. And I think, do we have time for one more? We had a question about holding cells located on each floor of a courthouse are all required to be accessible. We have a provision that's unique to courthouses where we seek to ensure that each court room is served by a holding cell when you have holding cells serving each courtroom. And so the scoping can be a little bit different. The technical criteria are pretty much the same, but they can be a little bit different when we're dealing with a courthouse facility in terms of scoping. If you have one central holding location, we would apply, we would require access just in that location. But if you have cells individually serving different courtrooms, then we would require each courtroom to be served by an accessible cell. And in most cases, you need vertical access on all floors of a courthouse regardless.
Okay, I think we're about out of time at this point, and I wanted to end with our slide here that tells you the contact information for technical assistance at the Access Board. So the number is here, 800-872-2253 is our technical assistance hotline voice number, and the TTY number is 800-993-2822. If you have questions that you would prefer to send via email, you can send them to ta@access-board.gov. Or you can visit our website at www.access-board.gov. So at this point, I'm going to turn it over to Robin for some further instruction, and also mention to you that our next session These are monthly sessions. You know they occur on the first Thursday of each month. Our next session is on September 6th, where we're going to be discussing accessible webinars. So, Robin, I'll let you take it over from here.
Thank you, Dave, and thank you to Peggy for your excellent information today and covering a broad range of issues related to detention and correctional facilities. Thank you to everyone for your participation as well. This is the conclusion of the session. The session has been recorded and it will be available within the next 24 hours on the website www.accessibilityonline.org. And you will be able to access it under the archive session section, where you will also be able to access all of our previous sessions. We post with the archives not only the recording, but also a copy of the handout materials. So if you did not download the handout materials prior to today's session, they will be available for download on the archives page as well. So thank you, everyone. And in order to disconnect from the session, all you need to do is close your browser or use the little disconnection icon in the lower left-hand corner of the screen. Looks like two little connecting cords going together. If you click on that, that will also disconnect you. So again, thank you very much.